This is our third episode. We're very excited.
Yes, and this episode, we're actually here with a guest today.
An amazing guest. He told me not to call him Dr. Ty, so it's Ty. He's really cool for us. It's Dr. Ty. He's a professor. Well, he used to be a professor here.
I'm a professor now, emeritus. I'm retired, and I have a computer that's the property of the university. That's part of the perks of being emeritus.
Oh, that's emeritus, amazing.
Okay, I don't know what that
me
is
either.
Exactly.
Well, some people who are very grand and are beloved of the university.
Right.
I'm being sarcastic. And are beloved of the university get a title of emeritus.
Okay.
You retire with special merit, and then they give you stuff.
Okay, so do you get it, like, consistently, or is it just like...
I have that computer. It's been there since 2013.
Okay.
And I can come in and have it serviced, or I can have this fine gentleman do stuff.
Right.
I can walk around campus and go to the library if that library were open, or whatever the story is about that.
Okay.
And so forth. So
I think it's open now.
Yeah.
And, there are some other things like that. So there are these little perks that you get.
That's awesome, though.
I'd been traditionally a thorn in the side of the administration of the university. And so it's sort of surprising that they did emeritus stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I was on the original collective bargaining team for the union, and that's not always been happily greeted at the university, as you know.
Right.
Et cetera. And, but there was a lot of good that came from that over a period of years. And that's from the early... mid-late 70s when that union was formed. So it was here up until just recently.
That's
right.
Amazing.
And you were a part of it, like the beginning?
I was on the first, well, yes, on the first collective, I was vice president for the union.
Okay.
On the collective bargaining team, first collective bargaining team.
Mm-hmm.
And that was difficult if you were trying to learn to teach people at St. Leo, which is what I was trying to do at the same time.
Right.
What did you teach at St. Leo?
Religion and philosophy.
Which one did you prefer? Did you like one more than the other? Or?
You know, that's a very reasonable question.
Right.
And Martin Luther King did his PhD dissertation at Boston University in systematic theology. And it was on Paul Tillich, German professor who had immigrated to the United States since Germany was a mess, and another man named Henry Wieman, who did like a process sort of theology. So this is very elevated and abstract stuff, but it mixes religion and philosophy is
right.
Where I'm going with that.
Mm-hmm.
And myself, I never... really separated them, because I don't think they're separated in Nicole or Alex.
Mm.
You can do it in a way that separates them out. But just to tell you, the Eastern Church said, you Western guys went and separated stuff out, like the Russian Orthodox and Greek Orthodox, and you said, this is this, and you went all secular, you built a bunch of cars, and now everybody's running around saying, where's God at?
Right.
So it was more in there would be difference in emphasis. If I'm teaching world religions, there's more emphasis on what you'd call the religious ideas that they had. But in India, they were integrated too.
Right.
The philosophers and what we call philosophy and theology is not easily separated off in even in China. I mean, Confucius, were you like philosophy or were you religious or something? And That's hard to separate it off that way. And it's the same for Socrates, and Jesus and those early people. Now, there's a reason that people do that, and you can do, I'm going to say, particularly philosophy in a way that leaves religious stuff out of it, and you can be religious in a don't ask me to question anything kind of a way. And I wasn't happy with either one of those things. It didn't come natural to me. And in the Catholic tradition, for that matter, they were wedded for a long time. People like Thomas Aquinas and so forth wedded philosophy and theology together. And Aquinas was a genius, and Augustine, St. Augustine and whatever, he didn't separate this stuff out.
Right.
I mean, he did something more one way, something more the other. Just mentioning Augustine, he did this reflection called The Confessions, but it was autobiographical, mm-hmm. and you may not know that, but people didn't write autobiographical stuff like, I was a real a-hole here when I did this. I mean, no. Of course, he wouldn't use language like that, but
right.
he was talking about things. It's sin. He did it by way of confession. So
well, he's talking to God.
Yes.
Sort of way.
Yeah. And, but of course, he was actually talking to us, mm-hmm. for us to hear. But when we hear of individualism in the United States and what do you think, which is what I tried to do in my courses, that's an Augustinian kind of push. Just to give you a different example, my stepdaughter, studying Chinese stuff and so forth in graduate school, in one summer is working in China for an outfit to help prepare students to get into American colleges. These
right.
would be well-to-do Chinese
mm-hmm.
people. And one of the things that she tried to get them to do is write the essay where you would say, this is me, and I'm going to do whatever.
In the introduction.
And it was very hard
mm-hmm.
because generally they're not asking, well, what do you think about so-and-so? I'm exaggerating a little bit.
Right.
But this is a Western,
right.
Particularly European kind of thing, push that came into our category. And you and I here wouldn't be talking without it. Without
right.
those ornery Plymouth colonist people saying, we're not going to take it anymore off England government trying to boss us around about what we're thinking and so on.
Right.
So all of that is a kind of a mixture of religion and philosophy. And so in my courses, sometimes you'd emphasize one thing and sometimes you'd do
the
other.
But you
never
separate them.
Not yet. It's only for a particular practical purpose that you would do it.
Right.
So like for a specific class, you would do something just to get...
Yeah, and a kind of a question. There are certain things that you don't have to talk about God necessarily, just to say how the Gospel of Mark was developed. That can be kind of a literary thing, you talk and so forth. But anyway, I always thought, well, who cares how the Gospel of Mark was developed if you don't have religious questions?
Right.
Exactly.
And so on. So, mm-hmm. And the same for... the Plymouth colonists, they come over here and people are talking now about, well, I don't know, should government help? And that they write that Plymouth document, the Mayflower Compact,
mm-hmm.
on board ship on account of a mutiny.
Right.
All right. They took upon themselves to form a government. They weren't able, they couldn't ask anybody's permission if they wanted to. There they were with a mutiny. They formed that, and that's the core idea in the development of our own government now.
Mm-hmm.
These were religious people, and they called it a covenant. That's the same word that the ancient Jewish people were using for their relationship to each other and God. These guys were being very biblical in their
yeah.
mind. That's
mm-hmm.
what they wanted to do. And so they were, bringing together a tradition of both individualism and being critical.
Right.
Right. Now, there's limits to that. You all got to get along somehow and so forth, and I'm not claiming there's any way to figure that out, but it's particularly Western, and it blends the two together. But if you just think of, and of course, Martin Luther King did this to beat the band. You can talk to Martin Luther King and say, well, what part of you did of that was philosophical, and what part of that was just like your religious kind of thing? In Paul Tillich, whom I happen to have met once, because he spoke at University of Colorado when I was a student there. And I spoke to him, and I got his autograph.
That's
on
amazing.
Volume 1 of Systematic Theology. And I actually spoke German to him.
Okay.
And you want to hear the German?
I said,
yeah.
I do.
I said, Dankeschön.
I don't know what that
means. What does that mean?
It means thank you very much.
Okay.
Dankeschön.
And he said, bitte. Which is what you say. That's kind of a joke. I mean, there's not much speaking in
right.
German.
Right.
But for religious interested people, which I was a philosophy major, but I was a religious interested person, you could meet with him in a group. And he gave three big lectures there at the university. And so there were about 13 of us or something like that met, and he talked. And I'm still talking about philosophy and religion.
Right.
And he said he joined they used to have a Christian fraternity, and he joined it, and they said, you're not supposed to have any doubts.
So don't question anything.
Basically, that's it. And here, these are Lutherans. He was Protestant, and in Germany, that's largely Lutheran, Protestant stuff.
Yeah.
And he said, what? You know, what do you think Martin Luther did?
Right.
I mean, he has some questions. You're like, you're actually selling forgiveness to, like, go into heaven or something like that? Is that what you're doing? And when did Jesus say go sell stuff? Et cetera. This is questioning.
Right.
To do it. And so he thought and developed a theory that doubt is a matter of faith.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of your faith that you can do that and that you can think through things. And maybe you won't come up with all the answers, but still have the faith that that's okay to do it and go ahead anyway.
Yeah.
And that's the reality of life.
Yeah.
I think growing up as a kid religiously, we were always so scared to question.
Right.
And then you get to university and you're like, oh, well, question is good.
Yeah.
Having questions. I feel like I grew up and I made my communion. I mean, I didn't do my confirmation, but I made my communion when I was younger, and my mom's Catholic and things like that. And I've always had questions, but you know, my mom wanted me to go to church, wanted me to do this. So I did it. You know what I mean? But Alex said, as I get older, I'm allowed to question things. You know what I mean? There's no one stopping me from doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's more, again, I mentioned, this is an oversimplification, but still, there was Socrates, who was, let's say, more philosophical, and there was Jesus, let's say, who's more religious, but they were both in a Hebraic tradition and one in a Greek tradition, and the cultures were different, but there's a lot of overlap, if you look at it. It's not the same, but there's a lot of it. And God knows, if Jesus wasn't questioning stuff, how come he got in so much trouble?
Very true.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Very true.
Because he did. Mm-hmm. He got in a lot of trouble. And so did people don't often really reflect on this. But I was thinking about it the other day. I mean, we know it, but reflecting on it, not only he, but it would come to be that followers of him ended up being legally executed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Peter and Paul, etc., and others, and then this would multiply in the Roman Empire as this movement went out, because so there was something questioning about that going on, questioning fundamental governmental structures, and are people being treated decently that way, or is X going on? And basically, that's Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a perfect segue into Martin Luther King. So I was told by Professor Silver that you dealt with a lot of conflict with religion and, you know, rights for black and whites, right for separations.
Sure. Yeah.
And I wanted to know if you wanted to talk more about the struggles of dealing
with that. I sent you a picture, right?
Yes.
So that's did you see it?
No, I did not, actually.
You're really missing something.
Okay, I'll look at it.
It's a young
sure.
Martin Luther King. He's like 31.
Oh, you had told me we were meeting. I didn't see it, but she had told me that you had sent her a picture.
So you can hardly find, I found the picture on the internet a little while ago, probably when I was going to speak with Cam's class at you know, he was a student of mine once upon a time.
Yes,
he
did tell me.
Well, that's an example. I mean, how different could two people be, Cam Silver and me, right?
Right, yeah.
But in the course, the way I tried to organize it was to let people with journal writing and things of that sort bring forth who they are and do reports on stuff they're interested in or whatever that is. And he just flat did it and, appreciated that kind of approach. And I think he appreciated that I was fine that he be his own self.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
Doing what he's doing because, you know, I'm not the boss of the world about what somebody's supposed to think, et cetera. This thing, you know, is supposed to open up and people bring their own selves along, you know, in interaction and dialogue with other people. Anyway, so I'm a sophomore at Brown University. This would have been in November of 1960. The context was John, I don't remember if John Kennedy had won the election yet or not.
Okay.
I saw him at Brown's in Providence, Rhode Island. And so I saw Kennedy and Jackie up there, you know, giving a talk at a train station. They were going through on the train station. A bunch of people from Brown and whatever came down. And it was humorous because he must have been just in friendly territory because he would say, now, I believe so-and-so. And they'd say, yay, you know, exaggerate, yay. And he says, but my opponent. And they'd say, boo, like that. And so the, you know, that was the context. John F. Kennedy, JFK, and Martin Luther King. This is in the all going on in my head in the same month, and which, as you know, is sorrowful if you think about it in a certain way. And I got to be careful thinking about it because it's upsetting.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Right.
Anyway, so there was a guy, Martin Luther King, whom I didn't know anything about, but I did know who my sociology professor was, who was also associate dean of the university. Mm-hmm. And I held these people in high esteem. We go into this, they called it a convocation. They wanted people to come together for important things.
Okay.
So okay. That's what this is. And here's this young man. And you can tell he looks very young, right? And
right.
My professor was introducing him, and we'd been reading in class things like John Dollard's Caste and Class in a Southern Town, which was about segregation and stuff and whatever, sociology texts with Freudian psychology in it and so forth. So I was thinking about these things.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm from West Virginia.
Yeah.
And which was segregation light. I mean, you could eat at restaurants, but the schools were segregated, you know. So,
yeah.
It's still segregation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm interested in it. I'm respecting. I'm in a low awe of these people. And Dean Schultz was a sort of dramatic, spastic even kind of a guy. And here he was. I don't know the right word. I'm going to say abasing himself and the whole Brown community, and where there's a bunch of white faces sitting there, in front of this young man, Martin Luther King. And I wasn't used to my professors acting like they were going to take second place to anybody. Because
right.
These were powerful people.
Right.
At university, particularly if you're from West Virginia.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which there weren't, but hardly anything like that in there, at least not the quantity, all assembled together like they would do there. And I thought, you know, holy business. So, you know, that caught my attention. In the same year, the university, I guess, was tired of being regional and small-minded, and they got somebody from Gandhi's group. Gandhi's dead,
that's
of course,
amazing.
Assassinated by then, to come
right.
And give a talk. And he, remember really clear what he said, you know, that there's a force that holds atoms together and things of that sort. For human beings, that force is love.
Yes.
Well, this is Martin Luther King, too. So I'm getting hit, you know, with this. Message.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is so far removed from what everybody does most of the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, we're all having a pretty hard time with this stuff. And the Vietnam War had not started yet
mm-hmm.
at this time that I'm talking. But is it gonna, et cetera. And so anyway, there was that. And then finally I ended up at a seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. And Martin Luther King came for a march on Frankfurt, which is the capital, in 1964. And so this is 4 years later.
Well, you were graduated by then.
I'd graduated from University of Colorado at that time. I started at Brown, but I finished University of Colorado. And there are two important women I could talk about at some time if we get back around that. But so anyway, the seminary itself said, you know, we don't officially have classes and stuff. They basically closed for that day for people to go. You didn't have to go, but so many people wanted to go that was it. So basically, the whole seminary took off and went to this thing, and there were about 10,000 people.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no violence.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
How old am I, right, that there could be like that? But you know there was violence in the air because people were getting killed and whatnot. That was 64, so the four young black girls at church had already been killed by a bomb in Birmingham and so forth. This stuff had been happening. All this is in the air. So when we went, and I don't want to portray myself as a big courageous person, but there was some fear, too, at the same time.
Right.
Somebody
sure,
just
right.
lobbed some kind of stuff into the crowd that they didn't like.
Right.
Right? Because, to give an example, another example is that we're up there on that march. University of Kentucky, I know you all have heard of the game called basketball,
mm-hmm.
had no black players.
Mm.
And they were like number one just about in basketball at that time. But that's the way, this was when this is going to start changing. So that was the kind of time in it. So that was, at that particular march, a lot of what King liked to happened. There were singers like Peter, Paul, and Mary singing, "If I Had a Hammer," hammer out justice and freedom and all that stuff. And,
did you have any companions come with you to this?
My wife at the time.
Oh, okay.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
But it seemed like maybe it would be easier than it turned out to be. Historically,
yeah.
It turned out to be harder.
Yeah. Yes. Surprisingly. Because when you think about the idea of love for all equally, it's a simple concept when you're teaching it to children.
When you say it, it's
when you
simple.
Say it, it's a very
love
simple
all. Like,
concept.
Why wouldn't you?
Why
almost.
Wouldn't you? If you tell a little child that everyone should be loved the same,
right?
The reason that they won't love them might be not because of something they physically can't change. Maybe they have a toy that they want. Maybe they don't get along because the other one's always bothering the other one. But it's never because of a skin color, or your hair is longer, or your eyes are a different color, or whatever religion you practice, what you believe, or who you love. It seems like something that you actually have to forcefully teach someone to do. I think hate is so hard to do. You have to physically teach someone to hate someone else. And I think that people do what they see their parents do, and it becomes a tradition. And unteaching that tradition at a college level is extremely hard, but even harder for professors who taught this kind of behavior. And so I think Martin Luther King was an amazing example because he was reteaching a group of people to do something that, like you said, was scary because he wanted no violence.
Right.
And so you were just getting the backlash, or you're getting the backhand of everything, but you were supposed to keep faith, like Jesus says, turn another cheek, and just keep on going.
They're pouring ketchup on your head in a restaurant where you went and sat down at the bar up front, and training not to lash back.
Yeah.
At that, you might be right about children. By the time people are older, they got 1,000,006 reasons to be nasty, mm-hmm. angry, out of sorts, looking around for X to go do something because of whatever.
Right.
And then the work is to cultivate other things in them. At that same time, so I was a student minister for two churches in southern Indiana that didn't have a regular minister. That's part of the seminary stuff. And so I'm giving a sermon basically on Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
To the smallest of the churches in the South. And when I say southern Indiana, I'm saying southern Indiana.
It was southern.
Okay. And they were nice people in their way, right?
Yeah.
And some of them wanted to do better, but the leader of the men's Bible class didn't. And this is the last time I saw him. So we're filing out the door after the service, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
How do you do? How do you do? He came up and berated me for what I was saying about Martin Luther Kuhn.
That's terrible.
No kidding.
Like.
And I didn't exactly know how to get out. I didn't think he was going to give a harangue. And then people were going around me because they could see that he was haranguing and so forth. But, you know, what I mean by that is that's the time.
Right.
And there were, but there were other kinds of people in the church, too. They were both there.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't all violent racist kind of people.
Right.
They all had, we all had in West Virginia, a race consciousness that you wouldn't have if you grew up in Uganda.
Right.
And but there's a difference between that and wanting to deny people rights that are clear, you know, and so forth. And they wanted, there were people that wanted to do better. And so he was, I think he was in a minority in the church. But he was leader of the men's Bible class.
Right.
So he was like, blah, blah. And I just mentioned that as the time that was in.
So I have a question about being in that time and not being racist and
right.
being a white man.
Right.
How did that, like, obviously you said the guy who approached you, he was obviously white, right? Like, obviously.
Everybody yeah. in southern Indiana was, I'm exaggerating.
But, yeah, white. So did you experience a lot of backlash from a lot of other white people for standing up for what you believe in? Or was it something almost like unspoken about and they wouldn't say it directly to you? Like, how did they, or how did that happen, or how did it go?
I was largely in educational circles.
Okay.
And, you know, I mentioned I was at Brown those for 2 years before I went to Colorado. But both of these places were very open about that thing. Actually, Colorado would be more, even though it was much bigger in numbers of people, it would have been a little more parochial mm-hmm. than Brown and Providence, Rhode Island, and just short from Harvard and Cambridge and stuff and so forth, where it was located there. So I'm trying to think. Most, I think the short answer is no, not with the people, but if I got, you get very far outside of the people. Like where I'm living now, I live in a blue-collar area.
Mm-hmm.
My own belief is that the United States, for a period of time, I'm going to say Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, who went after trust busting, even though he was Republican, but so was Lincoln, no kidding. Lincoln, Republican, Theodore Roosevelt, FDR. There was an expansion kind of a thing, Eisenhower, of caring mm-hmm. for people. We didn't have a Social Security for farmers until Eisenhower put it in. That's Republican. And that there was this expansive sense of social justice.
Right.
And taking, the country had the wherewithal to take care of people that needed to be taken care of and so forth. There was this movement that way. And a lot of educated people at that time, counting myself as educated, were sympathetic to this.
Right.
So I didn't get it that way. I've got it now in my blue-collar area, tradespeople, plumbers, whatnot, who, because what I think has happened is the United States was confronted with Martin Luther King,
mm-hmm.
and he said, you know what? We're plagued by the triple-headed giant of poverty, racism, and militarism. This was in 1967, April 4th, 1 year before he's in Memphis and assassinated.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a speech he gave at Riverside Church in New York when he came out against the Vietnam War and linked that violence there with violence in the United States. That speech was denounced by the New York Times editorial board and by the Washington Post, who were the liberal things of that day.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so he had gone, in their view, a bridge too far. And my view is that the our parties moved to the right. The Republican Party moved to the right, and the Democratic Party moved to the right. And got very friendly with rich people, Democratic Party, which was had been traditionally pushing this, the later Democratic Party. The earlier pushes for this kind of stuff was Republicans with Lincoln and then Teddy Roosevelt. Anyway, so I think that my blue-collar people have been left out in the economic growth of the United States, and I would say particularly relatively white people, and they notice this, where black people still worse off than white, but have gone up some economically, where the white working-class people haven't. And so I'm thinking, our government abandoned them. And, in my view, created Donald Trump. And so with my people, I talk to them, and they think, what do they think? One of them gave me 2 gold coins for Trump. I think they're gold plated. And I don't try to correct them.
How do those even exist?
Huh?
How is that even a thing? Like, how did they get those?
Oh, well, the Trump outfit would have been pushing this as a thing to contribute, I guess, to you contribute so much money to the campaign earlier on, and et cetera. And
here's coins with my face on it.
Yeah.
I understand. But I could get people mad at me if I wanted to, but I don't.
Right.
Because they would think I don't support them. And I do support them. They've been screwed over. That's what I think. The way they address it is Trump. I think that analysis is mistaken, but they're not asking me for that kind of analysis.
Right.
So what I do is I'm sympathetic with them about our government, you know, X, Y, and Z. And so I would encounter it now where I'm not in some academic thing. I live with, like, plumbers and stuff.
Yeah.
And which I use. I mean, I got a neighbor that fixes
right,
my plumbing.
Yeah, no, nothing wrong with it.
And and I'm sympathetic with him. I think the fact is something has happened to them over the last, I'm going to say, since the 70s and so forth. And, you know, the woman that was killed at, I'm still kind of a sexist because I really don't like it, that a woman got killed at the Capitol. Because I think men and women are different, and you're not supposed to kill women.
Agreed.
So anyway, she voted for Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't mean that she was some grand whatever, but there were people in my blue collar area. I know at least one that voted for Obama. And stuff did not work out as far as they could see. You know, continuing that. This woman was a soldier in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's the kind of complexity now is, you know, if you talk, well, you're a racist and stuff. I voted for Obama. But if you're feeling you're being screwed over, and people are telling you that Hillary just met with the bankers, Goldman Sachs, and said you're in a basket of deplorables because you're homophobic or whatever it is, you know, that you're sexist, you're homophobic, and whatever. That's a basket of deplorables. So she did not vote for Hillary. She voted for Trump and became a Trump person. She ended up there, and now she's dead.
Right.
Again, you know what my view is. I'm sort of talking Martin Luther King here. There's a basic movement towards loving everybody and stuff of justice where people get taken care of. And we move in that direction, and we remove the reasons for violence and complaints, because actually people sort of don't need the reason to complain. I don't know, my toe itches and stuff, and I'm cranky.
Yeah.
They need help in loving one another. And our country has done well by the wealthy people.
Yeah.
Yeah. definitely.
Okay.
Always.
It's not all bad. It's done well for the wealthy people, but that's not the thrust that you need when you want people to feel together as one society, and that if we have the means to take care of people, we do it.
Right.
And that's, you know, and when Martin Luther King, I'm saying, link that up to international violence. And that was, our country did not want to accept that kind of analysis, so that was Vietnam, and so we went into Iraq. And none of these things, I don't want to oversimplify this stuff. I know all of these things are complicated and interrelated and this, that, and the other thing, but it seems to me that he's fundamentally, Martin Luther King has been vindicated. And that early impulse that I saw with Emmett Brown is true. And the choice is you either follow that or you don't. And if you don't, bad stuff happens. And women get shot at the Capitol.
Yeah. Talking about the storm at the Capitol, and the entire event itself was, for me personally, as an African American, as an immigrated woman, I was furious. I was furious. I was, if I'm being candid, I was furious. And I was furious not because of... I was furious about the whole thing, actually. I'm just going to be completely candid here. It was, you know, we talk about what we do for each other and how we stand. And Martha Luther King believed in nonviolence. We talk about the Black Lives Matter movement. And I'm not saying the entire Black Lives Matter movement was nonviolent, but the ideal... And the majority of it was nonviolent.
The picture was painted differently.
It was painted differently with the media because, you know, the media can be brought. And there are people out there causing violence to give that Black Lives Matter that attachment. But majority of it was very much nonviolent. That was the ideal and the base. And it was completely policed. Completely policed. And the Capitol, quite frankly... What were they really protesting for? You know, elections come out, people go out and vote. You know, you campaign, you do your best. You lose, you're supposed to, you know what, this person ran.
You say, I lost.
I lost.
Yeah.
And, you know, 4 more years, this is a democracy. Go again. You cannot forcefully take something that the people want. That's not how democracy is, and that's not what we believe in.
All right, where I'm going at that is that there might as well not be a Martin Luther King Day as far as what our country believes in.
True.
Now, Biden might do something different because he's seen a lot of SHIT go down, right?
Very much.
He's been Mr. Middle of the Road, but he's not talking middle now. He's talking about bringing about changes and stuff, and maybe he will. But... I think the working class was abandoned.
I definitely agree. I do think the working class was abandoned.
And then people who have, for whatever reason, an itch to misinform and agitate now have something to work with now that this has happened. And, of course, if you train people in Afghanistan and Iraq, and if you have a country which says, you know, you can't be American unless you have a right to shoot people if you want to, right? Right to bear arms and go around and do stuff and whatever, and stand your ground and I can shoot them. And that is about as far removed as, let's say, Plymouth Colony trying to set up and do its stuff once upon a time. I know about Indians, Native Americans, but that's a little bit later after these very early days that I'm talking about there. So I'm trying to say the Capitol thing would not have happened if the parties, and I'm going to say the party that ended up saying this is what we do, FDR, and that was the Democratic Party, that primarily, as far as I'm concerned, the Democratic Party failed to carry through on Martin Luther King's vision. It wasn't just the Democrats, but that's my allegiance, and I'd rather criticize my own group than other groups. I mean, I can sit around and talk about Republicans all the damn day. I mean,
right,
right, right.
Right? I mean, I was there with Richard Nixon, right? And he, I mean, just think about it. So he introduces OSHA. He had an Obama-style plan for medical care, and EPA, Environmental Protection Agency.
Right.
This is Nixon.
Right.
The Republican Party got so far removed from that sort of government business that everything moved to the right. Blue-collar people, not just white people, blue-collar people pretty much got abandoned and created an anger in the country that there were people that make money, they call us names, and they're screwing us over.
Yeah.
And they're making themselves rich at the same time. And they don't mind us fighting wars for them either.
I definitely agree.
And so there's this anger is there. And Trump gave them a voice. And, you know, when people are angry, they think not nice things.
Mm-hmm.
So he said not nice things, right?
All the time.
And he was bold enough to say it for them.
All the
right,
time.
Right. And they said, that's my voice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm trying not to blame
people.
What you say is right. I mean, of course they shouldn't do that. I mean, I agree.
Right.
But I'm sympathetic to the psychological condition in them that was created by not following Martin Luther King when it was laid out.
So you basically look at everything with racism, people's decisions and what they believe by like how they feel about like politics and basically that. I don't know if I worded that correctly.
No,
did you get what I was trying to say?
No, I think what he's saying is that our world leaders, if I'm phrasing you correctly, are responsible for how we as individuals feel and act in our actions. Yeah. And they were abandoned or they were left out.
So now
they're frustrated and now they go lash out.
Yes.
But it was the responsibilities of us to, it's kind of like a parent teaching a child. It is your responsibility to teach a child how to react to certain negative situations. If you don't do it correctly, you don't do it positively, they will react negatively.
They throw temper tantrums.
Yes, you cannot be mad at the child when the reason that they're acting that way is because they were taught to act that way by the leaders that we elect in office. And I do agree that the working class is completely, you know, not being taken care of. And as a college student, it's fearful, like it's scary, because when we get out of here, we're not going to immediately make a bunch of money.
No.
We're going to have to work our way up. And if the middle class doesn't exist, we won't be able to work our way up.
Right.
We'll be stuck underground. And then a bachelor's degree won't be nothing or won't mean anything. You'll need to go get a master's. And a master's won't mean anything. You'll need to go get a doctor's. And then everyone's just going to have to become a scientist or something because there's no way.
Yeah.
If the government doesn't begin to take care of everyone, no matter what the economic grounds are, everyone, it's going to be either you're rich or you're poor. Either you have it or you don't. No matter how much education you have, no matter how much heart or soul or passion you put into what you believe in, either you have it or you don't.
Which makes some people want to go get guns.
Yeah. And it makes people crazy. It makes people mad.
I mean, there's a lot of people that are plumbers that are not going to be going to college and stuff. For sure aren't going to get a master's degree.
Yeah.
For one thing, they don't want to, even if they have that talent. And so the next thing is, you know, is somebody going to speak for me? And Trump said, oh, I will, which I don't think he in fact did as to what he carried out. I think he did some good things. But as far as these working class people, programs to help them, I don't think so.
No.
And that's the irony of, imagine, stretch your imagination a little bit, that you were a big Trump supporter and that you were hoping, you know, that things would work out for you. Not only did he not do these things for you, but you get then at the end, what are we getting at the end? Here's the end.
He just got impeached again.
We're just settling for whatever we settle for.
Now that's right. That the thing that I voted for got impeached
twice, or something like that.
Made history.
And it's like it's just everything is coming down against me.
Mm-hmm. And these people, you know, they receive a lot of hate just by Trump wearing, you know, Trump hats and things like that. And there's jobs and people losing money with certain types of tweets or support. in any of that. And then he loses. He didn't do anything that he promised to do. And now you're stuck in this world where people will always remember you as being this person.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, they lost out. They put their hopes in Trump, and they lost out again. One, just straight of what Trump did not do. And the secondly thing, they see this election, and then somebody starts telling him, like the President of the United States, well, it was stolen. Now you really feel
they believe it's
over.
Stolen, yeah.
That's right. Now you're screwed over twice.
And then you storm the Capitol.
And that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense. What you're saying totally 100% makes sense. How they feel cheated. They wanted Trump to represent them. That didn't happen. Then he gets impeached. But, you know, it's just right. They just feel let down completely.
Yeah, this is, you know, where's my gun at? And, you know, and we have trained people in the United States. We have a lot of people who have been in wars and so forth and come back and so forth and feel like they know about taking action to do things and how to organize stuff and whatever. And it's just a hard situation. And, again, going back to Martin Luther King, I think he put his finger on it. This was at the Riverside Church, like I said, April 4th, 1967. And you know, back then with me, you were asking about me, 1963, Kennedy is assassinated. Mm-hmm. 1968, Bobby Kennedy reads out Martin Luther King's assassination. He's on the campaign trail. Bobby Kennedy is on the back trail. Then a few months later, he's assassinated. So that's part of my thinking and emotion going into into this business.
It's almost like you're watching all of the people who believe in peace and believe in nonviolent protesting being annihilated. It's causing fear. It's causing, like, don't do this.
Yeah.
Don't question this. Don't rile people up. Don't gather people around to change and give other people rights. We're not doing that. We're just going to keep killing them off. Don't do it.
And it's not even, you know, what our political moral ideals are. It's not even like giving them rights. It's just doing the rights they're already given.
Right.
Yeah.
What they are. Yes. What it says they
what
have.
What they were born with.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, I think the moral leader was Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
And that he combined the religion and philosophical stuff, like I was saying, and then he was not followed.
Yeah, and he was forgotten.
Because
he had a fundamental criticism of what the United States has been doing and the path that it was on in the light of its own ideals.
Right. I think that, you know, sometimes when I look at our age group, I think that we sometimes maybe are going back to that idea of, you know, peace and protest and putting our feet down and speaking up. I think that at the beginning, it was a big hashtag thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Someone was killed by the police, you know, hashtag their lives. And then 24 hours, it's over, it's forgotten. But honestly, during quarantine and during isolation when coronavirus first started, I saw a lot of people go out there and I saw a lot of people who put out their emotions and their feelings into mm-hmm. their art. And they're marching and they're on their knees and their hands are up and they're, you know, screaming, don't shoot. And I begin to think to myself, you know, maybe our generation can remember what it feels like to stand up for something. If you want something to change, you have to speak about it. You know, closed mouths never get fed, and you have to begin to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like the violence. I don't ever agree with the violence. I think the violence gets nowhere. You know, everyone has a right to feel how they feel, but how you act upon that action is what is reflected upon you and what type of person you are. You can be angry, you can scream, you can shout, as long as you don't hurt anyone else. So I do agree that maybe isolation made everyone a little mad. I think everyone was stuck in their rooms. All they would see was news and news and news and news, and nothing was going their way.
Well, the pandemic, I mean, that's one of the, that's like the largest disruption of American life generally,
mm-hmm.
you know, in my lifetime. And even when they talk about early things like, I'm going to say, the flu of 1918 or whatever that was, they didn't have the transportation that we have now.
Mm-hmm.
Get in a plane and fly off to somewhere and do whatnot. So these people have a lot of reasons to be frustrated about something, and some of them don't have jobs or something because they were like restaurant workers or something, and what happened to that, or working at a mall, you know, and so on, and or in the travel industry where you're going to travel to where, you know, and stuff, and or at the hotel, what hotel, you know, and so on, and there, that's frustrating. I mean, that's just, I was saying my toe itches, and that's a problem. This is like way beyond that, and it's on everybody at the same time.
You're going through it, I'm going through it, John's going through it out there, the guy walking down the street's going through it. It's not just us. It's not just one group. It's not just one person. It's literally everyone in the world, except for like the countries that have gotten rid of it.
And then you go on media and you're watching the people that you've elect argue over and over again about whether you should be taken care of during a national pandemic where you can't work, whether, you know, you should be given money to pay the bills that are still going to come, even though
bills are coming
out of control. No one can work, or I can't go back to work because people would die.
Yeah.
Right.
It's common sense that, you know, you would think, okay, we put these people in office, let's see what they do. But then you see the bills come out and you see $20 million for this corporation and $15 million for this corporation. And we're going to keep Walmart open because we're going to give them money so they don't go bankrupt. And we're going to keep this organization. And then you're thinking about the middle class, like you said, they're frustrated.
What about us?
What about us?
I get it.
Oh, we'll argue about giving you $2,000. We'll argue.
It's debatable.
Debatable if you might get $600 after 6 months.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. It's I understand.
Very interesting. We're living in a very interesting time.
Yeah, it's not boring. I mean,
not at all.
What kind of terrible thing is going to happen next?
Yeah.
Hopefully nothing. I'm just...
Yes.
I'm hoping it's... I'm thinking I just want it to be like consistent and then better, like consistently what it is now and then it just gets better, because like more downhill. I think everyone is not for it.
We're exhausted.
Yeah,
we are absolutely exhausted. I think everyone is exhausted, especially I think in every aspect. People, parents who can't afford to stay home with their kids, have to send their kids to school, fear of them getting sick, especially younger kids. Kids missing out. I think kids missing out on graduation and prom is like minute.
Yeah.
When we think about the grand scope of things, I feel you. You want to go to graduation, you want to go to prom, but you can do it on Zoom. It's not that bad.
Right.
It's not that bad.
Yeah.
But I do agree that, you know, Martin Luther King is, he's given us the framework, and all we had to do was keep teaching it. And like I said before in the beginning, that when you teach a younger kid, it's harder to teach a kid to hate than to teach a kid to love. And I think that our government elects, when we're going out to these elections, we need to educate ourselves. We need to go out there when they're giving speeches and asking them questions about what they're going to do if there was another national pandemic. What are they going to do if there's a social injustice uprise? What are you going to do when people are feeling like you're not being protected by the law? How are you going to handle that? Are you going to go inside and debate for 6 months about whether we should get $600? Or are you going to go out there and, you know, figure out what laws need to be changed?
Right.
And how we need to modify what we do for the people. And I think a lot of middle classes are so frustrated. I think a lot of our generation is so frustrated. We don't do any research. I think older folks do way more research than we do. We go on social media and we go, who's trending? That's who we'll vote for. Hashtag who. Who are we voting for? And we see these tiny little tweets and we're like, okay, we'll go for Hillary. Okay, we'll go for Biden. No, we won't go for Trump. We need to do more research.
Right.
And I always say that it's not about, we're very polarized.
One of the things I was looking at recently is this QAnon stuff. So one of the things that's, I think that's important, is a little human nature issue there. You can be educated and reflective and a QAnon person.
Mm-hmm.
This stuff, human beings have it in them to gather together and do some mighty weird stuff.
Yes.
Like, without a lot of coaching,
right.
You need a little help. You need a theory to tie it together. There's an international cabal of pedophiles working out of Washington, and Trump is leading the secret resistance to it, or whatever the thing is about that, and on. And there's, while you're sitting isolated at home, you can be reading these things, and you know you've been screwed over one way or the other, and maybe this would explain that. What I mean by this is there's something that's not, in a small sense, rational. Like, I can do math. Not in a small sense rational about human beings.
Right.
Now, ancient people often would say, well, they're outdated because it's a devils are influencing something or whatever. The Russian writer Dostoevsky wrote a thing called Demons, sometimes called the Possessed, mm-hmm. about a town and a people that was overcome by a spirit, bad spirits. And this was not, you could not isolate this. I will do a sociological study today or a study in physics about it or so forth, but the results were clear enough as it took over people's way of thinking.
Right.
And that human beings are susceptible to that. And it might be rooted in, partly in the fact that we need to be able to spontaneously agree about some ideas, like to get along.
Mm-hmm.
But that same thing can be open to junk and terrible ideas
yeah.
at the same time. And you can get caught up in them.
Right.
And that's, I guess, what I want to... If you look at Martin Luther King and his history, which, you know, we know about, just because you're nonviolent doesn't mean you're going to have a life without violence.
That makes a lot of sense, yes.
And if you want to get out there, like you were talking about getting out there, and if you want to get out there and mean nonviolent, that doesn't mean anything. That doesn't mean that no violence is going to happen to you.
Right. Someone in the other group can
right.
be violent.
Right. That's right. And I have a low opinion in a certain sense of, I did my master's degree on Freud.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I don't think you have to hunt up violence in a human being. I think it rests there waiting for a little incentive and thing to come out and
right.
do what it's going to do.
Just trigger you.
And so, in a sense, human beings don't need excuses to be violent. I mean, and since we can talk and make up stories and do that story, we can create fantastic images of stuff that just talk but have real violent outcomes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm trying to speak a little realism here.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody was going to get out and do stuff, that you can run across unhappy people on the other side that would be violent.
Right.
Yes.
You can't control others.
Yeah, that's
only
very true.
Yourself.
I wonder if Jesus ever said it. You know what I mean? I mean, one
yeah.
of the examples in our tradition is Jesus, and you know he did not have a happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
No.
As a lot of people, I feel like a lot of impactful people or like important people do not.
Right.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of what happens when you try to
go
make change.
The
yeah.
the right. culture.
So
the
I've got my two Trump coins sitting there. I have a cleaning lady come by and she said, "Where'd you get those things?" You know, and so forth. And
so
I said, "Somebody gave them to me."
Yeah. So I just had one last thing. I just had one last kind of thing. I didn't know. I was just wondering, do you have a message for people? Just final little thought. I mean, I don't know. I mean,
yes,
obviously.
We're running out of time. What would you tell our generation?
Yeah, would you have anything
to keep in mind
to say to us?
Well, keep it up. I mean,
My
day's done about this stuff. So,
right.
I mean, somebody's got to do it. You know, mm-hmm. I take care of three cats and my wife, she works. That's what I do. I mean, I do more than I think about this stuff all the time.
Right.
Right. But I mean, somebody's got to be active too.
Mm-hmm.
And keep it up. I mean, I think you've got the wherewithal. You've got educational opportunity. You live in a country that still lets people think if they want to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they don't like it all the time, but you can. And if you guys give up, we're done.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you.
Thanks for
coming
on and talking
show.
To us.
We're out of time.
I know.
We had so much fun.
It was great.
Yes, I hope
thanks
our
for having me.
Of course.
Of course. I hope our listeners enjoy this when it does come out.
Yeah. All right. Thanks.
All right. Thanks.